find absorbing feature articles online. abc.net.au/rn.
Hi there, I'm Patricia Carvelis and this is RN Drive. And it's been a huge day in federal politics. Parliament's back for a special sitting to deal with the government's double dissolution trigger, bills to re-establish the Australian Building and Construction Commission. But comments about the Governor-General by Labor Senator Stephen Conroy have proven an unwelcome distraction for the opposition.
A strong Governor-General would never have agreed to this.
Well,
if the Queen had been asked to interfere in the British Parliament in this way, there is no way on this earth this would have happened.
Stephen Conroy has been chastised for his remarks by the Prime Minister and now also the Leader of the Opposition. More on the day's developments coming right up. But speaking of disrespect...
When you disrespect Australian law, they will tell you firmly.
I am truly sorry that Pistol and Boo were not declared. Protecting Australia is important.
Johnny Depp and Amber Heard with that very bleak public service announcement for Australian biosecurity. The highly anticipated sequel to their blockbuster misadventure, Puppy Pirates of the Gold Coast, the saga of Pistol and Boo. The act of remorse has earned the famous couple a gentle tap on the wrist for not declaring their terriers when entering the country in 2014. It was a mob scene at the Gold Coast courthouse this morning when the couple arrived. I'll catch you up on all of that at 6:30 tonight. And in the drawing room, we're talking about living to work at a job that you love. Here, two successful businesswomen share their secrets to hiring happy workers. And stay with me across Australia, online and on your mobile. It's 6:07. Parliament is back in Canberra today for an extraordinary sitting. And extraordinary has pretty much been the word of the day. Truckies converged on the lawns of Parliament House. A Labor senator verballed the Governor-General. And now it seems like the debate over the construction watchdog, which was supposed to take weeks, might be over at any moment, as in literally at any moment in the next half hour, is what some people are predicting. Senator Mitch Fifield is the Communication and Arts Minister and also the Manager of Government Business in the Senate. Welcome back to RN Drive.
Good to be with you, Patricia.
And I know you might get called away for a Senate division at any moment, so let's get straight into it. Why are you expecting the debate on the ABCC to end and a vote to be held so soon?
Well, there are two speakers left on the list, Senator Lazarus and Senator Cash, that would conclude what's known as the second reading speeches, and that's when we would have the first vote. Now, the reason why we have got through the order of business in pretty quick order today is because the eyes of the nation are upon the Parliament, and so Labor are compelled to behave responsibly. When they thought no one was looking in the previous sitting weeks, they filibustered and filibustered and filibustered to try and stop this legislation even coming to a vote, which is why we have recalled the Parliament to give it the opportunity to determine this once and for all.
And the ABCC bills won't pass the Senate, will they? I mean, I'm going to speak next with Ricky Muir, but he's told the Senate he's not voting for them. Jackie Lambie is the same, and Glenn Lazarus and John Madigan won't support it either. You just don't have the numbers.
Well, on the public statements of those crossbench senators, the ABCC legislation would not succeed, and we'll know within about the next 20 minutes. And that's a great shame, because we do need to have a strong cop on the beat on our building and construction sites around the nation. People have a right to get about their work. Industries should have the opportunity to be as efficient as they can be. That's what we want, and should the ABCC legislation not pass, we do have the constitutional mechanism to resolve the deadlock, and that is a double dissolution election.
You say it'll be a shame, but coming into this process, a number of senators, David Lionhelm yesterday told Sky News that he thinks there's basically been no effort. Senator Lambie says there's been very low levels of effort to try and get a deal, to get the crossbench convinced on this. So are you really disappointed at all?
Well, those who know my colleague, Michaela Cash, the Minister for Workplace Relations, understand that there is not a harder working or more ceaseless or more determined minister than her. She has been working with the colleagues in the Parliament on this legislation for months and months. So there is no lack of effort on her part or the government's part. Nothing would make us happier than to get this legislation passed through the Parliament.
Then why haven't you been trying harder?
Well, McCarthy Cash has been trying incredibly hard, but the crossbenchers have made no secret of their disposition over a long period of time. Now, some have put forward the proposition of changing the bill that's before the Parliament into that of a broad-based anti-corruption body. Now, there may well be arguments for and against that particular proposition, but it's an entirely different proposition to that which is before the Parliament.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Senator Mitch Fifield. He's the Communications and Arts Minister, and when we talk to him, usually we talk about those issues. But he's also the Manager of Government Business in the Senate. 0418 226 576. We're hearing news that the ABCC would be voted on, well, imminently. We might lose the Minister any moment. I'm wondering if you can go through a bit of the process with us, because I don't really think voters listening, and a lot of the people that listen to RN Drive love politics, watch it closely, but still are quite in the dark about the process. If the ABCC bill fails, if it goes to a vote in the next 20 minutes and fails, then what does it mean for a double dissolution? You'll have your trigger. How will you use it?
Well, where a bill has been passed by the House of Representatives, put to the Senate and voted against, with a three-month gap in between, where that happens on two occasions, that constitutes what's known as a trigger for a double dissolution election. Now, that's just a fancy way of saying that it enables the government of the day to use the provisions of the Constitution to enable a double dissolution election. And the benefit of that is that after you have that election, there is the opportunity to have both houses of Parliament sit together, so that the government's numbers in House and Senate can combine to resolve that deadlock.
So just to clarify, if this vote happens in the next half hour, imminently, you'll consider that to be your trigger? What will the Prime Minister then do after that vote is counted?
Well, the Prime Minister has already made clear that if the Senate does not pass the Australian Building and Construction Commission legislation, that he will go to the polls in a double dissolution election on July the 2nd.
So this is it. The other bill that's also been previously rejected, which you've already got a trigger for, registered organisations exists as your other trigger, you'll have both bills fail if this happens in the next 20 minutes.
Both of those bills would be a trigger. And our founders recognised that there could be a deadlock between the House and the Senate, and they specifically provided for a deadlock resolution mechanism, which is a double dissolution election and a joint sitting of both Houses of Parliament. Look, it would be good if that was not necessary. It would be good if the Australian Labor Party could set sectional interests of the trade unions aside for a moment and look at the interests of those who work in the building and construction industry. But of course they won't, because the CFMEU is a good payer to the Australian Labor Party. They want that money, they want to continue to receive it. So the last thing the Labor Party will do is to set that sectional and self-interest aside.
So what does it mean for the Parliament? Because this is getting dealt with, I think you budgeted 3 weeks for this issue. It's by the end of the first day, if we see this vote voting the ABCC down, what do you do for the rest of the week? Are you going to deal with the truckies legislation, what, tomorrow or the next day and then go home? Is that the idea?
Well, it's very important that we seek to and hopefully will succeed in repealing the Road Safety Tribunal legislation. It is standing to put owner-operators out of business. It's shocking legislation. There's a real community understanding, I think, of just how bad this is, how bad Labor legislation with the intent of forcing out owner-operators and increasing union membership could be devastating saving for this particular part of the economy, putting mums and dads out of work. So that's really important that we transact that business before we leave. And look, if we transact that business and the other other bill that we have before us, then look, we can be out of here later this week.
How quickly do you predict that if the ABCC bill is put tonight and will ultimately fail, if you believe the declared positions of the senators, and then this other bill comes up, when could you actually realistically be out of the parliament?
Well, it will depend how many people want to contribute to the debate. Ultimately, it's in the hands of the Senate chamber. But it's very interesting that when the Labor Party think that no one's looking, and let's face it, in the Senate compared to the House, we're usually a little bit off Broadway. When Labor think no one's looking, they'll filibuster, they'll delay, they'll use all sorts of procedural tactics to prevent the orderly consideration of business and actually getting legislation to a vote. But when the whole nation is watching, as they are with the recall of the Parliament by the Governor-General, it's very interesting how their behaviour changes. It's incredible the effect that sunlight can have.
Well, Mitch Fifield, thanks for joining us. I know you've got to go, and we'll be watching this very closely tonight, as of course you will be, because you are a senator. You're in there. Thank you so much. That's Mitch Fifield, the Communications and Arts Minister and the Manager of Government Business in the Senate. So, you know, he's actually effectively responsible for how the government conducts itself in the Senate and prioritises things. And he's pretty much said that in the next sort of 20 minutes, perhaps, there's only a few speakers left in the Senate now. The whole reason the Senate was brought back, Peter Cosgrove speaking today and delivering that contentious speech, was effectively to see if a deal can be done on the Australian Building and Construction Commission. And really imminently, we might see this bill voted down. So really quite a dramatic night in politics, given this is the trigger the Prime Minister needs. This is the trigger he's been looking for to go to a double dissolution election on July the 2nd. And he might have it, as I say, in the next half an hour, all on our watch. And we'll be bringing you the latest on RN Drive as it happens. You can text us 0418 226 576. I'm getting questions already. Oh, you didn't ask him about this? Well, I didn't have him for very long, unfortunately. And I wanted to just get the technical stuff out of the way to find out exactly what's happening tonight. Now, one of the crossbenchers who will vote against the ABCC bills and hand the government a double dissolution trigger is the Australian Motoring Enthusiast Party's Senator for Victoria, Ricky Muir. Senator, welcome back to RN Drive.
Thank you.
Are you absolutely committed to voting the ABCC bill down now that it comes to the Senate?
I did do my second reading speech earlier on and did flag at the very end of it that if the government wasn't willing to accept my amendments, we might as well just give up now and give the government what they want, and that's an election. And I had in principle support for some of the amendments which I wanted to move from the minister previously, or that's the feeling that I got, should I say. However, as we got close to this sitting period, that support seemed to get pulled back a fair bit. And, of course, I've heard directly today that, no, it's not going to happen. So, to me, it just felt like this was nothing much more than a script which was going to lead to a double dissolution election one way or another, and the blame was going to be put firmly on the crossbench.
So you're giving into the script, or are you trying to change the script?
One of the things that gets out and about regularly, and it has been for quite some time, is, oh, the crossbenchers will vote to protect their job. And anybody who's in it for themselves would do just that. But there was amendments which I'd like to see debated. I've been told outright that it's not going to happen. I couldn't support the bill in its current form. I do come from a blue-collar background. I do understand that the likes of coercive powers is something that should concern a lot of people. You know, your right to silence is generally a fairly strong right, and that overpowers that completely. So trying to reduce the strength that those powers have but still allowing it to happen is a very big concession on my part. But if they're not even willing to discuss it, we might as well pack up and go home. Prorogue parliaments costing the taxpayer for the Senate to sit $1 million every day. The government says we're tight. Let's get out of here.
So what amendments of yours did you put forward that were completely rejected? Because you just said there that you didn't even get a discussion on some of your ideas. What have you put forward that was blankly, you know, thrown out of the the window said, when did Michaela Ukash say to you, nah, I won't even talk about that?
It got thrown out of the window completely after my speech in the chamber when I went and had a quick discussion with her.
Can you tell me what happened in that discussion? I can hear the bells. I think it's all about to happen.
I think the bells are ringing and I've just been told I have to go, so I must apologise.
All right, let me just clarify. You're about to go now into the Senate and vote against the ABCC?
It would seem that way. So it's on. I must run. Sorry about
that. Absolutely. That is your job. You are a senator, and that's Senator Ricky Muir. There you go, live radio. And they are the bells you heard there. The Senate bells are ringing right now, people. And the senators are all, I'm watching them on the TV at the same time. They are all walking now into the Senate, taking their seats, preparing to vote on the Australian Building and Construction Commission. Remember, this is what the Prime Minister has built his entire political strategy around. He's using this as the potential trigger, which he will take to the Governor-General for a double dissolution election on July 2. He's nominated the date. And just there, we were speaking to Ricky Muir, who is one of the crucial crossbench senators who will now vote against the ABCC. And make it very crystal clear that there's no chance of this legislation getting through the parliament. The government has its answer. The crossbench has spoken, and Ricky Muir making it very clear there. I had other questions for him, but he is a crucial vote as a crossbencher in the Senate, and I think he's on his way to do that right now. 21 minutes past 6 on RN Drive. I'd love to get your views. 0418-226-576. Are you relieved it's all getting dealt with within a day? It's the first day back since the Parliament's been prorogued, and there you go. It's getting dealt with pretty much, at the end of a business day. 6:21, and they're all coming into the Parliament. Well, on
this is a special occasion in parliamentary democracy.
What a disgraceful position you adopt.
The minister will adjourn his seat.
You've been warned twice. That's your last warning.
Well, there you go. I got overexcited there because we are about to have a vote in the Senate, and on such an eventful day in federal politics, I'm very happy to have with me someone who has seen plenty of days like this, perhaps not exactly like this, but certainly very dramatic days in the Parliament. Peter Harcher is the political and international editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. Welcome back.
G'day, Patricia. Pleasure.
It's all happening right now as you and I are entering this conversation. I think we might even have a resolution. You never know by the time we finish our conversation. This is quite a day, isn't it? We started the day with the Governor-General delivering a speech, and now a vote this quickly. Why is this all happening so quickly?
It has happened quickly, hasn't it? Well, the essential reason is that the government is giving no ground, and why should it? It set the terms and made the demand. It issued the démarche, if you like, to the Senate. The essential reason is that crossbenchers, have want to write themselves a suicide ticket, really. That's what this is for most of them. They had talked themselves into a position so adamantly, so passionately of opposition to this and high dudgeon that the government had treated them high-handedly on other matters, and especially on that question about the rules for flow of preference in Senate voting, where they felt the government, they didn't just feel it was objectively true that the government had changed the rules to make it harder for micro parties to get elected to the Senate, that they've shown their indignation by writing themselves out of the picture. Because, as you know, Patricia, this now brings on a double dissolution which will wipe out most of the crossbenchers who've now brought it upon themselves.
That's right. Well, we were just speaking there. I'm sure you heard a bit of it with Ricky Muir, who's literally had to leave. You heard the bells in the background. Bit of drama there on RN Drive to go and vote against this bill. Now, he votes against this bill and makes it almost, I would say, impossible for himself to get re-elected. Is he crazy brave?
Probably crazier than brave, I think. Is it really such a priority for the crossbench to oppose the reintroduction of the Australian Building and Construction Commission? Remember, it existed for years during the Howard years. It's not like it's a revolutionary new thing. It's the reinstatement of it. Is it really so objectionable to them that they're prepared to sacrifice their positions in the Senate? So I don't think really it is, Patricia, but they'd talk themselves into such a position that it made it hard for them to back down. So not only is Ricky Muir walked out on your show, Patricia. He's now going to have to walk out of the Senate. And as you say, he will not be re-elected. He got up into the Parliament with less than half of 1%, less than half of 1% of the vote in his state. And he was only able to do that because of the rules which allowed the so-called preference whisperers to engage in these intensely complicated preference swap deals, which allowed micro-parties like his, quite unawares to the voter going into the booth selecting their Senate preferences to get into the Senate. Without that, he's history. So he's walked out on you, he's walked out on the Senate, he's walked out on any career in the Parliament.
Let's put it all into some context, and I would love to update listeners as well. Right now, senators look like they are all mostly in there in the Senate chamber, ready to vote on this legislation and ready to vote the ABCC down, so all breaking right now. But we've seen two big polls published today, which both seem to confirm the same thing, that things are getting tight for the Turnbull government. We're now locked into effectively a July 2 election after this breaking news, which is happening right now. Is this good for the government?
Well, you mean that they're going to lose the vote and be forced to an early poll?
Well, yeah,
under their own
because
terms? Yeah.
Then, well, actually, I should just tell you now that the ABCC vote has failed. The bill has failed and the Prime Minister has his double dissolution trigger. So there you go. It's happened just like that.
There we go. They now have several double dissolution triggers. They've got one related to climate change. They've got one related to registered organisations, and now they've got the ABCC as well. So Malcolm has an embarrassment of riches for election triggers if he really wants to use them.
There you go. He certainly does. So the government goes in with very tight polls, behind in one and equal, even Stephen, in another. Very difficult circumstances for them. Do you think the Prime Minister should be nervous about going to this election?
Well, You're right. Your earlier question before really raises the question of whether it's good for the government to go to the polls early. And based on all the movement we've seen in those polls in the last 6 months, the earlier he goes, the better his chance of winning, because he's been on a trajectory of falling support. Remarkably, Turnbull between himself and his party has taken the outstanding electoral asset in Australia, which was the person of Malcolm Turnbull himself, and brought the government from a position of commanding lead down to now, as you say, even Stevens. It's essentially the two parties are on parity. So if they'd continued on this same trajectory, things could have only gotten worse for Turnbull. Now that he will be able to declare an early election, they've got a budget coming up. He'll go to the Governor-General shortly after the budget, probably the week after the budget, ask for the early election, which he's demanded, be given it, and then go into a formal election campaign. That will first get the country's attention focused on it, second, give him all the extra attention and platform of a campaign. But if he'd let it run its full course, let the Parliament run its full course through to September, October, November, on this trajectory, they would be in much worse shape. So in that sense, it suits him very well to go as quickly as possible to the polls.
The government obviously made an assessment that running the Parliament for longer and longer and going through sort of what would be a chaotic kind of negotiation process may not work in their favour. Do you think they've made an accurate or correct political assessment? I'm asking a political question to make clear to our listeners as well, not a policy question, but a good political estimation that it should all be done on the first day back?
If in fact they're concerned by the polls, by that trend to ever diminishing standard, I mean, he's being called the incredible shrinking Malcolm. If they are in fact concerned by that, and there's every reason they should be, then they've made the right decision. If they think their best chance is to go early, then they've made the right decision. In fact, we are now left wondering whether in their own political interest, it might have been smartest for him to go as soon as he took the leadership in September to have an early election as early as February this year.
Well, it's certainly very interesting times. We look like we're going now very certainly to a July 2 election. Peter Harcher, many thanks for your time.
Pleasure, Patricia.
That's Peter Harcher. He's the political and international editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. And the ABCC legislation, the Australian Building and Construction Commission legislation, has been now rejected. And the government now has the trigger to call for a double dissolution election. The Prime Minister has nominated that date, July 2. It almost certainly will happen now on July 2. It would be, well, I can't even think of the circumstances for which the Prime Minister would not now go to a July 2 double dissolution election, a winter election. We haven't seen anything quite like this, all wrapped up within the first day back in Parliament. I've been watching politics for a very long time, but I've got to say I haven't quite seen anything wrapped up like this in the first day back. 0418 226 576, that's our number. I'd love it if you could join our conversation. Well, are you glad it's all been wrapped up so quickly? And are you enthusiastic about a July 2 double dissolution election? And what do you make of the budget now? We're going to have a budget before that July 2 election, before the Prime Minister goes to the Governor-General. Very interesting times politically. 6.30 on RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvelis on your radio tonight till 7.30.
Australia is a wonderful island with a treasure trove of unique plants, animals and people.
It has to be protected.
Australia is free of many pests and diseases that are commonplace around the world. That is why Australia has to have such strong biosecurity laws.
If you've ever been tempted to speed up your passage through arrivals by ticking no on the customs declaration form, let the experience of Johnny Depp and his wife, Amber Heard, be a lesson to you. The Hollywood couple appeared in a Gold Coast court today in what's been dubbed the War on Terror trial, and I just love that pun. I cannot help myself. What you just heard there is an apology tape they played in court. I've got to say, one of the weirdest apology tapes I think I've ever seen. And I really can make that claim. It is the weirdest thing I've seen. You just heard the audio there. Google it. You won't be wasting your time. ABC News journalist Tom Forbes was at the court today and joins us now. Hi, Tom.
Good evening, Patricia.
What was it like outside the court today? Mayhem.
It was mayhem is the word to describe it, or chaotic. Generally, when high-profile people appear in court, it's the media that care and not many others. But today, it was Australian media, international media, and then also Johnny Depp fans as well, all pushing and jostling to get a look at the star when he arrived with his wife, Amber Heard, just before 9 o'clock this morning. The car pulled up. Johnny Depp stepped out, walked around, opened the door for his wife, and very quickly they were descended upon. They managed to fight their way into court with the help of some security advisors. And then, of course, at the end of the day, once a lot of people realised that the couple was about to leave court, it was probably twice as hectic when they left.
So Amber Heard pleaded guilty to falsifying quarantine documents.
That's right.
What exactly did she do within that process? How did she do that?
Well, as you said in your introduction, there's that arrival document that everyone has to fill out when they arrive in Australia. She arrived on a private jet with Pistol and Boo in April last year. She was here to visit Johnny Depp, who was filming the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. Now, generally, when the Depps travel, it is the responsibility of Mr. Depp's estate manager to organise all the paperwork, vaccinations, pet transport. But somehow, in this particular case, it quote-unquote slipped through the net. So Amber Heard arrived thinking that the correct documentation had all been organised by Mr. Depp's staff and one of her personal assistants, who incidentally no longer works for her. So on arrival, she ticked no, she did not have any animals to declare when she arrived. And of course, once Barnaby Joyce, the Agriculture Minister, got wind, then it all became very public.
And we heard some of the video played in court. It's a very strange video. It's a very strange apology. Johnny Depp looks, I think, extremely odd in this video, and I don't know anyone who's disagreed with what I just said there. Pretty benign statement. Why didn't they just say what they had to say in court?
Well, I think what's happened in this case, and Barnaby Joyce alluded to that as well, is actually an offer made by the Depp/Heard camp to help with their court case. So the Barnaby Joyce said, look, it was up to them. The court could take or leave the video however they liked. But of course, the video has been supplied to the media. It's gone up on the Facebook page of the Agriculture Department and has gone quite viral this afternoon as well. So Mr. Joyce was happy to have a video that he could use to promote the fact that quarantine laws are taken very seriously in this country, and here's a video of Johnny Depp and Amber Heard to say so. Although one could question the production values, it looks like it's been shot in the hotel room here on the Gold Coast, possibly the day before today's court appearance. And it could also look like it's been shot with something like a smartphone as well.
Yeah, it's all very odd. And I know that Virginia Trioli from ABC News Breakfast has tweeted, and I think she's pretty much nailed it, that it looks like a hostage video too. I mean, it's just a really strange video. It doesn't kind of make sense to me. But Barnaby Joyce says it could be used to try and spread the word that you don't mess with Australian quarantine. We'll see if it will be used in that way. Tom, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Patricia.
And that's ABC News journalist Tom Forbes, who has spent the day outside the Gold Coast court where Johnny Depp and Amber Heard appeared for bringing their dogs, Pistol and Boo. I love those names. I can't get enough of the names of those dogs into the country without the correct paperwork. You're listening to RN Drive. Coming up in about 10 minutes from now, you'll meet an Indonesian academic with a very personal connection to the persecution of communists in Indonesia. The first public discussions on the 1965 massacre are currently being held in Jakarta, and we'll be talking all about that in about 10 minutes from now.
Hi, it's Michael Cathcart here. I'm sure that there are some books that you have read again and again, and some that were so striking that you'll only need to read them once. If you could choose one book which the rest of us simply must read, what would it be? Tell us in 50 words or less, and you could win a collection of this year's must-reads as chosen by the Sydney Writers' Festival. All the details are on the RN homepage. Just click Sydney Writers' Festival.
And if you're wondering what on earth I'm talking about, we've posted that apology video by Johnny Depp and Amber Heard on our Facebook page. Really, you need to watch the whole thing. I'm not wasting your time, honestly. It's worth watching. Just make your own assessment. It's really one of the more bizarre things I've seen. But of course, it's going viral because it's really weird. And I've got some comments from you on that apology video. They certainly look pleased about having to present their community message. Perhaps the judge sentenced them for 42 seconds of community service. Very funny there. And on today's federal political news, which has all happened while RN Drive has gone to air, it basically happened at about 6:15. The ABCC legislation has been rejected and the government now has the trigger it's been looking for to call for a double dissolution election on July 2. So it's all happened. It's all done and dusted. It's quite remarkable, actually, how quickly it happened. And on today's federal political news, I was joined by Senators Mitch Fifield, who's the manager of government business, and also Ricky Muir, who had to leave in the middle of the interview to go and vote against the ABCC legislation. And here are a couple of your texts on all of those interviews. On your interview with Mitch Fifield, Australians are sick and tired of political scheming instead of governing the country. This latest is the icing on the cake. The government fiddles while Rome burns. And this, it is becoming increasingly clear that the government has engineered the failure of the ABCC legislation for their political agenda, but planned that strategy when well ahead in the polls. We don't need strategy. We need representative government for all Australians. And did the Governor General recall the Parliament, or did the PM really? Did he choose this? And coming up tomorrow on RN Breakfast with Fran Kelly, as the debate around Labor's proposal for a royal commission into the Australian banking sector continues, you're going to hear from Professor of Commercial Law Ian Ramsey. Now, Labor was using that issue, that royal commission into the banking sector, in Question Time. It really did dominate in Question Time. They were asking many questions about it, so you'll hear more about that royal commission, or at least the proposal for that royal commission, on RN Breakfast with Fran Kelly tomorrow from 6 to 9 every day. And also coming up just before 7, sport as we always do on a Monday, and that very strange report about swimmer Grant Hackett. The steel industry in Australia is not the only industry under threat due to falling commodity prices and steel production in China. The future of recycling could be under threat as well. That's the stance being taken by the Australian Council of Recycling, or ACOR, the peak industry association for the recycling industry. Grant Musgrove is the CEO of ACOR, and he joins me in the studio. Hi, Grant.
Hi, Patricia. How are you?
Good. You say there's a big problem in the recycling industry in Australia, and it relates to the effect of commodity prices. Can you explain what the connection is for people who wouldn't necessarily make the connection?
Well, commodities, whether it be metals, steel, plastics, these are all things which are traded globally and impacted by government policy domestically. Obviously, their price is important for the market to work, and due to a range of Australian government policies, state government policies, and international developments in China, recycling industry is under absolute stress.
So say I have an old car that I want to sell for scrap metal. What will happen to it in the current market environment?
In the current market environment, you'll have to pay, once upon a time, not long ago, only about 12 months ago, a scrap metal dealer would have been happy to pay you for your 15-year-old car, you know, some hundreds of dollars. Now it will be a charge and will be simply bailed up and sent off to China.
Right, so Australian recycling companies are already exporting some of their waste overseas. What kinds of waste and where is it going at the moment?
Well, mostly it's going to China because China has behaved in, well, an extraordinary way, not in a way that anyone who thinks of markets would understand. So about a third of the world's steel production is now coming out of China. There is no market for it. It's simply being stockpiled. It's turning what was an asset only 12 months ago into a liability, and that cost will be passed on to mums and dads, and that's whether it's a car or an air conditioning unit or an old refrigerator.
So it's not just rare earths that's too expensive to extract and recycle in this country. It's even plastics and other computer components as well, you reckon?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when people think about recycling, they think obviously about, you know, maybe the packaging in their hand, but as virgin resources, that is mined resources from the Pilbara, for example, become increasingly costly to extract, that has flow-on effects to the second, so as the secondary resources industry, the recycling industry, for those same materials.
So the recycling industry, is it really being forced to look to exporting waste offshore for their future profitability? Is that a real part of the equation?
And under the worst possible circumstances, because they're being the offshoring occurs to low environmental performance and low wage countries. So you would have seen recently in the media, many of your listeners, the events in relation to OneSteel Arion being put into voluntary administration, and that's certainly one of the largest companies in Australia, and that is principally because of this massive oversupply from China and the lack of formal support for recycled content in Australian government policy. It used to exist. In 2014, the current Abbott government, or the previous Abbott government, abolished the formal procurement policy, which included a whole range of things, but one of which was recycled content. So we would prefer this double dissolution was about whether or not Australian companies should, Australian government should support local recycled content, but unfortunately it's not.
Should the industry look at other ways of solving the problem rather than blaming government levies or China's overproduction of steel?
Well, industry will do what industry is responsible for doing and are accountable to shareholders. We support very high environmental standards. We support policies which don't unnecessarily tax recycling. At present, we have a whole range of levies and taxes on residual waste that's not technologically or commercially recyclable anywhere in the world. That's propping up state budgets. Federally, we have a whole bunch of anti-dumping regulations, and I invite your users to use their favourite search engines to simply look at those. They exist. The government doesn't want to use them because they're afraid of upsetting China as our biggest trading partner. The advice I've been giving to the federal government is it's very well that China is our biggest trading partner, but they're also the biggest trading partner of 150 other countries, and we just ain't that big.
Grant, many thanks for your time explaining how all of this is connected. Very interesting stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Grant Musgrove. He's CEO of the Peak Industry Association for Recycling in Australia. I'm Patricia Carvelis on RN Drive, and soon we'll be moving to sport, where we'll be talking about ex-Olympic swimmer Grant Hackett's latest fall from grace. Also after 7 tonight, after the ABC News at 7, we're going to be talking about Bernie Sanders, from a man who's worked on a book with him about Bernie Sanders and his kind of real outsider campaign. Where did that come from? Why is it working? And what's the lasting legacy for the Democrats that's coming up after 7 tonight on RN Drive? And I've been asked this question from a listener. Given that the PM has several triggers to call an election, does he have to actually pull the trigger? And I reckon putting on my the party room hat, which you should subscribe to, that's Fran Kelly's podcast with me on the election, and basically the government has a trigger, so I feel like you definitely have to subscribe to our podcast now. It's very getting very, very hot, and we're very interested and excited about presenting that podcast for you on politics. But I will answer that question for you. The government can get a trigger, but they don't actually have to use it. So, yes, the Prime Minister will have his trigger. He doesn't have to use it. But think about the politics. He's pretty much said he wants to use it. So it would look very strange if he was to withdraw from that position and not call a July 2 election. So he doesn't have to. Of course not. He doesn't have to use the triggers he has. But it would look very strange at this stage for him not to. It's 15 minutes to 7 on RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvelis on your radio till 7:30. Changing the topic quite a bit here, the 1965 massacre in Indonesia remains one of the worst mass killings the world has ever seen. More than 500,000 people were killed after a failed coup attempt that led to the deaths of 6 senior army generals. No one has ever been charged over the massacre, but this week the government is holding a national symposium to publicly discuss the atrocity for the first time. Dr. Ken Setiawan is a McKenzie Research Fellow at the University of Melbourne's Asia Institute. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Patricia.
It's a big question to start the interview, but what was the 1965 massacre for people not familiar?
What happened in 1965 was that the Indonesian military seized control of the government after this failed coup attempt, as you mentioned. And after that, the military, under the leadership of then Major General Suharto, who would go on to become Indonesia's president, they successfully blamed this on the Communist Party. And what happened after that was basically a witch hunt on Communist Party members and their sympathisers, and that resulted in the deaths in over about a year of at least 500,000 people. That number is estimated to be much higher, so maybe 1 or 2 million. And also, in addition, tens of thousands of people were detained for years without trial.
And your father was a political prisoner. He was accused of being a member of the Communist Party. How did that status affect his life and your family and your life?
Well, he was actually a member of a leftist cultural organisation, which was associated with the Communist Party. So he spent almost 10 years in prisons in Indonesia without any form of trial or formal charge. I was born after his release, so I have not really experienced his detention firsthand. But people who are members or who were branded basically of being a communist, they, even after their release, life was incredibly hard. So they faced a lot of discrimination. One of the things that my father had to do was every year report himself to the authorities and then also report who, you know, was in his family. So that included my mother and myself.
These massacres were 60 years ago. Why is the truth and reconciliation process being discussed now? Why is it on the political agenda today?
Well, it's 50 or 51 years this year. It's coming on the agenda. I mean, after Suharto's fall in 1998, there has been more lobbying and a push to address gross human rights violations of the past. But when in 2014, Indonesia's President Joko Widodo, or Jokowi, was elected, became quite prominent because he included addressing past human rights violations in his campaign program.
That's right. You just mentioned that he was very vocal about human rights during his election campaign and this issue. Does the proposed truth and reconciliation process match up to what he promised during that campaign?
Well, he promised to finalise these cases. It wasn't exactly specified how. Human rights organisations in Indonesia have argued that this should be a judicial approach, so by way of an ad hoc human rights court. But what the government is seeking is a non-judicial or reconciliation approach.
Is there any link between Joko Widodo's stance on this process and his record on executions? I mean, many Australians will remember that he revived the death penalty that was basically put on pause and defended the execution of Australians Chan and Sukumaran. What do you make of that?
I think these are two very different issues. The death penalty has in Indonesia been very much, is also very much socially supported as a way of, punishing people for crime. So it's another issue rather than a gross human rights violation of the past. So it's I don't think we can compare the two approaches taken here.
And the symposium taking place in Jakarta this week includes academics, human rights leaders and victims of human rights violations.
That's correct.
Doesn't this show the government wants to take their views on board? Is it a real indication that it does want a really broad understanding of the way that it deals with this issue?
Well, this is the first time that the Indonesian government is actually facilitating a direct meeting between victims as well as government bodies, including the military, who were involved in the mass killings. So that in itself is an important step forward. However, reconciliation without truth remains very problematic, or it's unclear really to what extent the government is supporting a truth-seeking process.
And finally, the government says it's also ready to start discussing compensation and rehabilitation. What would that mean to the victims and their families?
Well, I think it really depends who you are talking to. Victims have also different ideas of what they want. But considering that many, many victims have lived in very difficult situations, of course, this is an important step forward.
And last month, the Indonesian Commission for Human Rights sent a letter to the US President Barack Obama requesting the White House to disclose confidential documents on that massacre. How necessary are those documents and the cooperation of the US to see this through?
It's necessary because this is, again, a part of truth-seeking. It's about putting that puzzle together. What happened? What were the lines of communication between the United States authorities and those in Indonesia who were responsible for the killings? So, truth-seeking is really a very important element of a genuine and a meaningful reconciliation process. So in that sense, it is important that the United States declassifies this information. For that, probably also a stronger push from Indonesia is necessary. And the US has actually released similar documents earlier, in particularly with regards to Latin American countries.
Thank you so much for coming in and explaining this. You've done just such a fantastic job of really explaining the background here and why this is so crucial in Jakarta. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Dr. Ken Sedyawan, who is a McKenzie Research Fellow at the University of Melbourne's Asia Institute. You're listening to RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvelis, and I've got to read this text message because it's kind of funny. I have to say, it did sound for a while there from the way PK and Peter Harcher were talking that tomorrow's big story would be Senator interrupts ABC radio interview for trivial political chore. You're important, auntie, but not that important. If we sounded like that, I think we were just kind of pretty excited that we were speaking to Senator Ricky Muir, and he was literally about to leave our studio, which he did, to go and vote on what is now going to be an election trigger, potentially a double dissolution trigger. And he did. Within 5 minutes of leaving the RN Drive studio, Ricky Muir voted against the Australian Building and Construction Commission, and now the Prime Minister, if he wants it, has another trigger to call a double dissolution election. Will he do it? Well, I think it. All the road signs are pointing that way. July 2, people, put it in your diary.
Can music with a powerful political message really be a force for social change?
Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit. No, you wouldn't say that anybody in the South in America heard that song and changed their behaviour, but it does act as a rallying cry, not a sloganeering rallying cry, but a much more subtle one.
Two acclaimed singer-songwriters and a music journalist discuss the complex relationship between music and politics. Big Ideas with me, Paul Barclay, tonight at 8 here on RN.
Triple gold medalist and Australian swimmer Grant Hackett has been the subject of lots of attention in the past 24 hours, but not because of his failed comeback to Olympic swimming. It's been alleged that he was drunk and aggressive towards another passenger on a flight to Melbourne yesterday. Tonight, it's been reported that Grant Hackett has contacted the other passenger and apologised for his conduct. Courtney Walsh is a sports reporter for The Australian and has been poking his nose into this story. Hackett has apologised this afternoon for his behaviour. Catch us up with the alleged incident and why it even matters.
Well, I suppose the harshest thing that's come from it this afternoon, Patricia, is that Mr. Slodnik, Martin Slodnik, the passenger in question that has raised the accusations, has said that he was sexually assaulted. Now, we know from what was reported, I suppose, late yesterday when we saw those distressing scenes of Grant in the airport where he was passed out, I suppose, in a wheelchair and after being escorted off to flight, a really appalling look. What was reported then was that, I suppose, he'd been tweaked a nipple of the passenger in front. Now, that's, I know on radio, that's what happened, but...
No, you got to say that it's the facts, everyone.
And that is obviously...
It's the allegation. He hasn't denied that, has he?
He hasn't denied that. And as I said, that's the allegation that's come to bear. And if Mr. Slodnik thinks he's been assaulted in that way, well, it's certainly a serious matter that, and as we know, the police are investigating it. But it's another, I suppose, a really sad event, regardless of that assault, that aside, which is very serious. It's a sad, I think, sight to see Grant again in this situation. He's had past episodes of criminality and wandering around distress since his, I suppose, when he first retired after his decorated swimming career came to an end. Retired again last week after failing to make the Olympic team, but was going to be seen, used as a mentor at the Olympics in Rio in a few months' time for young swimmers. Look, I just can't see that will occur now. That has to be in question.
And Hackett, of course, made a statement to the media, and in it he said, "I seriously and genuinely regret my poor behaviour. I have stuffed up more than once and am working on these issues." So a real public acknowledgement that this is a huge issue for him. You say that it's very unlikely that he'll now play that role in the Olympics. You think that's pretty much fait accompli? Is there any chance? I mean, there is some time.
Look, I suppose there's always a, you know, we see people redeeming themselves. But he is, as he said today, he's had chances on chances. It's an issue. I mean, he was given another chance in terms of commentating, did a very good job in last week for the broadcaster that was covering the swimming trials. So he got a chance there. He's got a chance to mentor the Olympic team. I suppose what the Olympic team might think is that by giving him this chance again, it may help him come out of whatever it is that's troubling him. And look, retirement for athletes is never an easy task. I saw a footballer last week talk about how for 5 years it took him to get over that. We saw another footballer on the weekend who played only a handful of games talk about his struggles with addiction and how he struggled to match that euphoria and come out of that. So it's not an easy task to come out of. Whether he's got the life skills, that might be an issue as well. And clearly it's a problem for him. So look, not fait accompli, no, but again, I'd be doubtful if he's working through these measures, whether you would put him in another, I suppose, high-pressure environment in the Olympics, even when he's not swimming. I think it's a pressurizer. Yeah.
You'd think that the Australian Olympic Committee would be quite paranoid about the consequences, the potential consequences.
And look, they had significant issues in London in 2012 with the swimming team. Mm. There was all manner of problems there. There was a report the next year, investigation into it. I'm just not sure, even from a public relations point of view, that will happen.
No. And in the Federation Cup, if we just can pivot a bit and change, move to tennis. In the Federation Cup, Sam Stosur bombed out again, which I find hard to watch every time. I want Sam Stosur to be great.
It's one of those things. And look, Sam, I think, is going to be somewhat maligned in Australia. She's bombed out is such a harsh term, but it's true.
Is that accurate?
Well, she lost to two players who are ranked below her, who don't have anywhere near the, I suppose, the deeds, but to be fair, played fantastic matches. Mm. And in tennis, it's one of those sports where a couple of points can prove all the difference.
And, Sam, and that's the magic of tennis too, that people can do that.
And she played like a marathon match late on the Saturday. Australia slips down 2-love. She plays again first up on the Sunday. She has a chance. She fights back, gets to 5-all in the third, and we've seen that so many times with Sam in Australia. Mm. The problem for me is that, look, I'm a real fan of Sam, and I think she's a fabulous player, and she's had a fabulous career outside of Australia and at Wimbledon, and they're the ones that most of the public in Australia recognise, the Australian Open, the Australian Summer, and Wimbledon. Elsewhere, her career is remarkable. The best, I think, career since late, well, certainly, and she was side by side with Hewitt, but she carried the sport for many years. So, look, it's just one of those things for Sam. She's a bit of news today. She's changing coach after the French Open. She's now into her 30s. Whether she can make one last run for a slam, we'll see. But certainly the clay court circuit, even though she's just lost two matches on clay, it does give her best chance to find some form, I suppose, in the next 6 weeks heading towards the French Open.
So she's only really got, you say she's in her 30s. This has been a bad little run. She's only got a really small window left.
Well, look, I'd think she's probably got 2 years left. But I think the results are showing. I mean, she won two titles last year at a lower level, but the results are showing that she's not the threat at Grand Slam level that she was about 3 or 4 years ago. So she's got to make it count now.
Courtney, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks
That's
for having me.
Courtney Walsh, sports reporter at the Australian newspaper. And a text on this, Grant Hackett is just another celebrity who thinks he's above the normal standards of decent behaviour. Standard behaviour for sporting heroes. After the ABC News, we're going to talk about Bernie Sanders. Hi there, this is RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvelis. Employers who hire people based on just their impressive CVs and just their qualifications alone aren't getting the best staff, according to my two guests in the drawing room at 7:15 tonight. Christine Corr and Angela Ferguson are very passionate and successful businesswomen, and they're going to join me in about 10 minutes from now to talk through their ideas on recruitment. And what they say is passion being the most important element to what you want to look for in a worker. I'm Patricia Carvelis, an RN Drive across Australia online and the Asia Pacific.
One of the great tragedies of American life today is the degree to which big money is buying elections, in which elected officials become responsive to the needs of Wall Street and wealthy campaign contributors rather than the needs of ordinary people.
That's US Senator Bernie Sanders speaking to CNN earlier today. It's a big week for the Democratic race for presidential nomination, with the New York primary happening Wednesday afternoon, Australian time. It will see Sanders, who grew up in Brooklyn but rarely returned, pitted against frontrunner Hillary Clinton, who has done the opposite, really. She adopted New York as her home and represented that state as a senator. Donald Trump will also put his New York values to the test in the Republican primary. John Nichols is the Washington correspondent of The Nation. He's written the update to Bernie Sanders' political autobiography, Outsider in the House, which is now Outsider in the White House. John, welcome to RN Drive.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
This book was first published in 1997. It chronicles Bernie Sanders' rise from fringe mayoral candidate to mayor of Burlington in Vermont to congressman, senator, and in your update, presidential candidate. When did you first become interested in the pretty different, you even describe it as strange, career of Bernie Sanders?
I think it's fair to describe it as a strange career, certainly in the American context. I became interested in Sanders when he was first, I guess, elected to the House, which was about 25 years ago, at that point from afar. But as a political reporter, I followed him through his career. And when he ran for the United States Senate, which was about a decade ago, I spent a good deal of time with him in Vermont, because this was a remarkable thing. While we had had the occasional independent and the occasional left-winger elected to the U.S. House, it was very rare for someone to get elected to the Senate. That's a much more powerful position. He got elected, and so followed him as he rose. And in many ways, that's the most fascinating thing about Sanders. When he was a mayor up in Burlington, and then when he was a member of the U.S. House, I think he was considered a bit of an interesting character. But as a senator, he really did become a national figure. And it's out of that status as a national figure that he's been able to put together really one of the more remarkable political campaigns in modern American history.
What's really interesting about his political career is how unlikely his success seems at every step of the way. Do you think this underestimation of the outsider is something that's really dogged his presidential bid?
Absolutely. But maybe it cuts both ways. Dogged it, unquestionably, but also benefited it in some other ways. The bottom line is that no one expected Bernie Sanders to be a viable contender for the presidency of the United States. I mean, he's genuinely a competitive player. Hillary Clinton has the advantage, but Sanders has held his own. And part of the reason for that is that over the past decade or so, he has very much emerged as the face of the political left in America. And in a sense, Sanders pulled together all the threads of environmentalists, trade unionists, activists in a lot of anti-war and anti-military causes. If you put all the pieces together, you've got the outlines of a candidacy. But again, I don't think certainly that the Clinton supporters, or frankly that most political analysts, imagined that that would be enough.
He's currently running for the Democratic nomination for president, obviously, but Bernie Sanders has been an independent for most of his career. And in this book, he's a real champion of working outside of that two-party system. But is the only road to the White House these days within one of the major parties? Why has he taken this road?
I interviewed Sanders before he decided to run, when he was thinking about it. And early on, he said he was interested in the possibility of running either as an independent or a Democrat, whichever would work. He does not have a lot of regard for either of the major parties. And so the only reason that he would have run as a Democrat was because he didn't think an independent run was possible. And remember that he's not so much of an outsider as regards the Democrats. In the U.S. House and in the Senate, he has caucused with the Democrats and actually developed some pretty good relationships with some Democratic Party leaders.
Is Bernie Sanders' time spent outside of the Democratic Party going to hurt him electorally, especially in a state like New York this week, where you basically have to be a registered Democrat, don't you, to vote in the Democratic primary?
That's exactly right. And you understand that in America, we have different rules for almost every state. And so New York is a state where the rules are very, very strict. You have to register early. You do have to register as a Democrat, all sorts of kind of a tightness to the process. And I think that that makes it harder for Sanders because he tends to attract independents. And he also tends to attract an awfully lot of young people, particularly new voters, people who have not been active in politics in the past. Well, those are not the kind of folks with a lot of experience voting in Democratic primaries.
Something Sanders writes in this book is, I refuse to give up on the idea that a campaign in a democratic society should include a significant educational dimension. Is that what his bid for the White House is, really, an exercise in education?
I think it might have been fair to say that at the start. I don't know that Sanders himself fully knew what would happen with this race. He obviously had hopes, but he's a very realistic guy. He's been around politics for a long time. And so I think he knew that it was an uphill run and probably an unlikely one. But something amazing happened in the summer and fall of 2015. They started to hold these rallies, and initially they were drawing 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 people, then 10,000, then some of them, you know, 20, 25,000 people, mostly young. And the Sanders campaign became a movement, a cause, at least for the people who were very passionate about it. And that, in turn, lifted his candidacy up to a much higher level than I think most anyone expected. My sense is that Sanders and his most ardent supporters think of it as more than just an educational campaign. They I think, have come to think of it as a candidacy that might break through in some way and actually, you know, really fundamentally change the Democratic Party, move it substantially to the left, particularly on economic issues.
In your update to the autobiography, you write about the tension between insider and outsider strategy. Do you think Bernie Sanders' decision to work inside the Democratic Party this time will succeed in making them address progressive issues? You just mentioned how effectively this campaign is moving the Democratic Party to the left on economic issues. Do you think it'll be a lasting legacy of this run to actually shift those politics fundamentally to the left?
I think there's a possibility of that. Remember, a couple things in play. Our Republican Party has shifted very, very hard to the right. And for a long time, the Democratic strategy was to kind of move into the center, to be, you know, a more moderate alternative to the very, very conservative Republicans. What Sanders is arguing is that that's not a very exciting approach, and it's also not one that solves a lot of problems. And so he has clearly gotten a lot of Democrats excited by the idea of standing as a dramatically more progressive party. And I suspect that no matter how well he does, that tradition or that idea, that new idea, will take hold within the party. It's clearly moved Hillary Clinton to the left on a number of issues. She's embraced a lot of political reforms, even talking about possibly amending the Constitution to get heavy spending on politics out of the process. But where I think the deepest legacy is, it's yet to be defined. And this is where it gets interesting. Sanders will undoubtedly come to the Democratic National Convention with one of the largest numbers of delegates of any dissident candidate in modern American history. I see that playing out in two ways. One, possibly in influencing the selection of a vice president and the platform of the party, just the structural things of the convention. But secondly, where you have an inspired or inspiring candidacy, young people who get involved with that may attach to it emotionally and ideologically for generations to come. And I do think that the Sanders campaign is likely to have a very lasting legacy, especially on a lot of the young people that are involved with the campaign.
John, many thanks for your time.
It's a pleasure.
And that's John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation and the author of the update to Bernie Sanders' political autobiography, Outsider in the White House.
The Ebola outbreak in West Africa 2 years ago was the largest ever. There was no vaccine available, but the reason for this was not scientific.
We couldn't make a business case to invest in making an Ebola vaccine against this dreadful disease.
So over 11,000 people had to die. Professor Adrian Hill from Oxford on how to deal with market failure and make vaccines affordable. That's Big Ideas online anytime at the RN website.
Hey there, thanks for coming. Take a seat.
It's time to retire to the drawing room.
Do what you love and love what you do. Sounds like the recipe to a happy life, but how easy is it to actually achieve it? Christine Corr and Angela Ferguson are both high-achieving businesswomen who've focused on passion rather than conventional markers of success. Both agree that employers would do well to look for passion in future employees. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have you both always loved what you do, or did you have kind of an epiphany to get there?
No, I have not always loved what I've done in the past. I've made major pivots, and one of them, well, the major one was 3 years ago where I actually had to run away to Uganda to realise how lucky I was to make the major change in my life, which I've done now.
Okay, you've just completely, you know, tantalised me there. Had to run away to Uganda, as
yeah.
You do. Why Uganda?
Well, you know, when I have a midlife crisis, men buy a car, girls run away to, and I went to
Uganda.
To Uganda. So I went with the Hunger Project,
yeah.
And I saw some frightful things, and I saw some amazing things, and I came back and I realised that I had an obligation to lead a passionate life, and what that made me do was completely change most things in my life except for my husband, which I'm pretty happy that I kept him.
And he must be pretty pleased too.
He's pretty happy. And that inspired my book, which is about higher love. It's about being passionate what you do, because at the end of the day, when you're passionate about what you do, it's not hard and it's very rewarding and it's great for you as a human being, but it's also great for your employers.
So why an obligation to lead a passionate life? In what way were you obliged, I suppose, to do that?
From a personal perspective, when I had my children later in life. I was 37 and 40. At 40, I had some trouble. If I was born in Uganda, I wouldn't be here today. My child wouldn't be here and I wouldn't be here. And what I realised is that I was living a life of obligation. And in fact, if I'd been, you know, so I should treat every day as precious. So I came back saying every day is a blessing for me. So I'm now going to live it passionately. And I think the other thing, I looked at my children and I said, I don't want them to lead a life of obligation. I want them to lead a life of passion. And they're not going to do that if they don't learn it at home. So
if you don't model it, if you don't model that kind of
thing. Well, they don't see it. They'll just see misery. People turning up, not loving what they do, complaining about it, waiting for Friday, thank God. I'm not that person. So, and I don't want my children to be that person.
Angela, does any of this resonate with you?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I think, you know, as someone that grew up in Melbourne and I was lucky enough to be able to go to university, there's immense privilege which comes with the kind of roles we get to do and the choices that we have. And there's a lot of people that don't have those choices. And I think there is a responsibility, an obligation to make the right choices for you and for the people around you. And that's certainly what's guided, you know, my career. I've never been particularly focused on end goals, but on the best decision at the time for the scariest, most exciting thing.
So end goals, it's interesting because a lot of people do focus on end goals, don't they? How is that limiting, do you think, to focus in that kind of way?
I think you can miss out on some amazing opportunities along the way. And some of the most exciting things I've done have been things that have seemed like sideways steps, you know, moving to India for a couple of years to take on a role in a leadership team there for ThoughtWorks was a very similar role to what I was doing in Australia, but the context was so massively different. And it's shifted the course of my career as well.
Are businesses too focused on end goals, Christine?
Oh, absolutely. I think many businesses are focused on the next quarter or the year. People make decisions in a very short-term way and not invest for the long term and not accept the ups and downs of their employees and their people. I'm a big believer that nobody is 100% productive 100% of the time. And unfortunately, I see too many changes where people aren't at their best because of many different reasons and they, you know, are no longer supported in that organisation. I find that really sad. And I find it sad as a marketeer, like pre being in recruitment, just the impact on brands as well. And just not having a long-term focus.
Is the business or the corporate sector in need of a kind of recruitment transformation? What do you think?
I mean, I think yes. There's a lot of aspects to that. And part of it is thinking more broadly about the impact that you have not only to quarterly results and shareholder results, but also into the impact you have on the community. Mm. The technology community in particular, for example, has a pretty poor reputation for attracting women and retaining women in the industry. And yet there's a huge amount of work that can be done if people decide they want to do it. There's a level of investment involved in that, but the returns that from what we've found so far are absolutely worth the effort.
So how can business grow the right kind of talent, Christine?
First thing is looking at the long term. Second thing is actually putting a different lens on their view. And I'm a big believer of, well, diversity, and that's a common question, but the reality is that there are natural biases. People have biases, and it's how do we go
and,
through...
And not only do they have biases, they don't know they have these biases.
Correct.
That's the most difficult part, isn't it? It's one thing to kind of identify the bias, but from the outside, but actually getting someone to realise they have their own biases. And not all of them are suspicious. Some of them are just natural. People like look for themselves,
that's
don't
right.
they?
Absolutely. You want to work with people that are like you. I met a very senior person one day and he said that he does all his interviews via email because he doesn't like want to know. And, you know, it isn't a tech company and he said a lot of it is done via email. But what it meant for him is that he's not biased by appearance. He's not biased by nationality. Mm. All he cares about is how well do they communicate in the written form because a lot of their work is done in that way. Now, he then took away his biases with respect to gender, age, appearance, and even the way people speak, you know, if they've got a stutter or if they're slow talker or a fast talker or all those different things. So, I mean, I love that idea. It's not necessarily practical, but I love the idea of taking away any opportunity to be biased, which is natural.
And if you do that, if you take away that opportunity to be biased, I wonder what you think here, Angela. Do you also get better people for roles?
Look, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, there's a million studies out there, maybe not a million, but many, that talk about the value of diversity and not just gender diversity, but diversity of age, of experience, of background,
yeah,
of
diversity
of language.
Is such a bigger thing than gender.
Yeah, and all of the studies that I've looked at have made it very clear that in a problem-solving world, in intellectual work, there is absolute concrete benefit to having that diversity in a team because you get that creative abrasion that allows for an explosion of new ideas as opposed to, you know, if I sat down with other, you know, middle-class Melbourne-raised women that, you know, were similar to me, we'd have the same ideas, unsurprisingly.
On RN Drive, you're in the drawing room where we're trying to have different ideas with Angela Ferguson. She's the Group Managing Director of ThoughtWorks in Asia Pacific and also Christine Kaur, who's the Managing Director of recruitment firm Chorus Executive and also the author of Higher Love. So when we talk about hiring people that fit the culture, Christine, we don't mean people just like us, do we?
Absolutely not. I look at it as having common values and aligned goals. In a weird sort of way, I look at it my own family and my own business. Like, we're all very different. We like doing different things. I've got, you know, my age group goes from 24 through to 57. Some are grandparents, some are, you know, still out on the scene, but we all have common purpose of what we want to achieve and common values of how we treat each other, how we listen to each other, and what we believe in at a very deep level, not on a superficial level, you know, because we all have differences. But I think that's what culture is to me.
So how do you recognise those values in other people? Because they're kind of intangible, aren't they?
Well, you spend time with people. and you speak to people, which for me through the recruitment process, I've seen that technology has made it very efficient. So you fill in a questionnaire and you send something off and you might do a 2-minute video and all these sort of things, but we're all on our best behaviour. So when you actually spend time with people, you can get a feeling of those people and what's important, and obviously how you raise questions.
And what role does technology have in all of this, Angela, in your experience?
Look, I think, you know, we are a tech firm. It's the core capability that we bring along to organisations and individuals, but it's about problem solving, and most problems are about humans. You know, technology is created by humans, and I've seen technology do great things, but nothing greater than I've seen a high-performing team do. So I think that there's no tool that's going to replace the human conversation. And the point you made about the conversation is we've actually built our recruitment process around a two-way conversation. It's as much about people qualifying themselves into our culture as it is about us sort of understanding more about them. And I think that's been incredibly important.
What do you mean by that? Can you expand on that, how that works?
So there's a number of conversations. So any candidate coming in the door is going to speak to a variety of people. So it might be a graduate, to a senior salesperson, to, you know, making sure they speak to both men and women across multiple roles, to be able to understand more about the culture that you're going to work in. And that might mean that people that are uncomfortable with certain openness aspects of our culture, we're openly supportive of diversity of all its forms. If someone's not comfortable with that, they're going to qualify out pretty quickly during that conversation. But at the same time, they also talk to their friends about those conversations, and people that are interested come in the door as well. So it's making every interaction with a potential candidate part of helping people understand who we are.
So how about passion? Let's get to the passion question, Angela. How do you recognise passion in people applying for jobs, and why is it such an important thing to look for?
We recognise it when we talk, when we ask the question. I guess we're in a slightly different boat because we're interviewing people for many different roles, so they're going to be far more honest with us than they may be directly going to an employer because they're trying to target the right answer when they're going direct. For us, we will delve down into why are they so proud of that event. So, you know, Patricia, what's your legacy here? What are you most excited about? You'll tell me something and I'll ask the question, why is that? And out of that, I'm going to understand what drives you. So was it the fact that your whole team got an award and you were recognised? Was it that you got the president's or the CEO's award? Was it that you got a massive bonus? You know, what are those things that you're passionate about and what drives you? And then out of that, we understand the cultures and what happens in other organisations, and that's where we match the two.
So is passion in that sense more important than lots of qualifications? Does it win over all of them?
Well, it's not. So I have a really simple thing. Skill without will is absolutely useless, right?
Skill without will, I like
okay.
it.
So, and I always think about my children. They know how to clean their room. They absolutely know how to stack the dishwasher. Do they do it? No. Could they do it? Absolutely. They have the skill. They have no will or desire. So my view is...
Do you have any tips on how my kids could do that too? Have you figured it out?
No, I haven't figured it out yet. Oh, bribery does work. But yes. I guess from my perspective, what I look for and what I always recommend is you've got to have a base level of skill and capability and understanding of how to do the role, of course. But I would rather take a slightly underqualified person with the will and desire and drive than an overqualified person or a very skilled person that actually doesn't care anymore because they are just poison around you, not because of them personally, but because they just don't want to do it anymore.
Mm. And they
drag it down.
Yeah, everyone else is affected by that mood,
correct,
aren't they, Angela?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. The impact of those toxic people just... The only regret I've ever had about moving someone on that's been like that is that I didn't do it sooner because the impact they have on others is just massive. Yeah, it's incredibly important. And when you think about qualifications, I actually think that things like passion and, you know, integrity and engagement with the world are part of the qualifications of building an organisation. So while, you know, a degree in a certain subject or things like that might give you the key to the door in the first place, it's not going to help you grow your career. It's that engagement with the world, intellectual curiosity, humility, and the way that you treat other people that actually allows you to grow.
So just finally, if I could start with you, Christine, and then Angela, if you could comment on this too. What do organisations need to do these days broadly to attract the best passionate talent, not only to attract them, but then to keep them?
Think about them and not about yourself.
Do you think everyone's capable of that?
I don't. And that's the sad thing. And I think, but it's really simple, right? If you actually put yourself in the shoe of the other person and understand what their motivators are and think about what's in it for them, to join you and to be part of you, you'll get such a better result rather than what I need. It's about me. It's about me. Nobody wants to be with somebody that's just about them. So I think that would be my simple thing. And right back at candidates too, you know, think about what you can offer to the employer to make them a better, you know, organisation and be more successful. And when you both care about being successful, the results are amazing.
Angela, you had a good laugh there at Christine's response. Why?
It was a good laugh. It was mostly, that's pretty much the answer I would have given. We see a lot of organisations spending a lot more time and energy understanding the experience of their customers. And I think it's not a huge leap to take those skills and abilities of understanding customers and how to best serve them and apply that to your internal stakeholders as your employees. So a lot of organisations have this knowledge and just don't apply it in this space.
Well, thank you to both of you for coming in. Lots of food for thought there. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And
thank
that's
you.
Christine Corr, Managing Director of recruitment firm Chorus Executive and the author of Hire Love, and Angela Ferguson, Group Managing Director of ThoughtWorks Asia Pacific. And that's it for tonight. I'll be back at 6 p.m. tomorrow. Next on RN, it's Extra with Geraldine Doogue. See you tomorrow.